Okay, well, as almost every other speaker says, I'm glad to be here. Thank the organizers. What I'd like to talk about today is a little bit off the sort of path that most of the other talks in the last few weeks have been devoted to. I want to talk about applications of gauge gravity duality that, well, aren't exactly aimed at condensed matter physics. They're more motivated by questions that had their origin in trying to understand heavy ion collisions. So really it's aimed at understanding the dynamics of high temperature phases of non-abelian theories, in other words, non-abelian plasmas. However, I have to start by pointing out that since everything we're doing is in the large N limit, if you think about some, well, large N analog of a quark gluon plasma, you have a whole lot of excitations. They have some characteristic temperature, which means they have some characteristic thermal wavelength, which is 1/temperature. And if you say, how many excitations are there per unit box whose size is that thermal wavelength, well, that scales as nc squared. So by that measure, even though this is high temperature physics, it is a highly condensed matter. Okay, so specifically, I want to talk today about problems that involve far from equilibrium dynamics. On the gravity side, it will involve horizon formation. And I have to say that the work I'm going to talk about was done in collaboration with my student, Paul Chesler. And even that probably makes it sound a little asymmetric. Paul did most of the work. Cut and paste failure. All right, two papers, one of which is definitely not, is more recent than the one shown there. Okay, anyway. The basic setup, I think we've had enough of an introduction, namely, imagine you're interested in understanding the physics of the simplest field theory to which gauge gravity duality applies, namely n=4 or maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. My perspective here today is that's an interesting theory. Let's try and understand its dynamics. And over the past half a dozen years, there's been an enormous amount of work devoted essentially to that. And I just want to point out that there's sort of an obvious classification of much of that effort. There's a lot of things you can do which amount to exploring the equilibrium physics of the theory, and we've heard a number of talks that are in that category. That includes exploring the equation of state, calculating correlation functions, looking at things like correlation lengths or screening lengths in different symmetry channels. It includes things like putting the theory in a finite volume and asking what happens as a function of the size of the box you stick it in, turning on chemical potentials, even turning on physical rotation. So all of that is examples of equilibrium physics, physics that you could extract from studying the theory in Euclidean spacetime. Just as an example here, I pulled a table of screening lengths in different symmetry channels. So that's an obvious starting point. But once you understand equilibrium, it's natural to think about near equilibrium behavior. And this includes all the physics that you can extract from understanding correlation functions, in particular equilibrium correlation functions, but computed in Minkowski space, so there is a function of real frequency. So transport coefficients, viscosity diffusion, thinking about quasi-normal modes. If you imagine coupling the theory to electromagnetism, in other words, you weakly gauge some U1 symmetry, you can describe that as calculating a photon emission spectrum, higher order transport coefficients, nonlinear conductivity, such as Andreas talked about this morning. All of these things are examples of physics you can extract by studying near equilibrium behavior. And I happen to pull out an example here of the spectrum of quasi-normal modes that's due to Andre and collaborators. So again, that's just a category of exploration of the theory in which there's been a tremendous amount of work and progress. Another category you could label probe dynamics, things where you've got this system, you're sticking some sort of probe into it, you're making that probe actually do something. From the perspective of the probe, it may be far from equilibrium, but from the perspective of the medium, you've hardly perturbed it at all. So a classic example was thinking about the physics of a heavy quark moving through this medium, and it experienced a drag, and you can calculate that drag force. You can then use this machinery, this dictionary of translating gravitational properties back to the field theory to do things like actually calculate an expectation value of the energy momentum tensor in the presence of this moving quark, and that produces some really nice pictures that show this is a quark moving supersonically through the plasma in this direction, and this is effectively a Mach cone in the energy density around that moving quark. And you can study what goes on. What's nice is you're doing it in an approach which is valid at all length scales. So on long distances, you see hydrodynamic response, but you're not using a hydrodynamic description which is only valid on long distances. Your treatment is valid all the way down to arbitrarily short distance. All right, there's been lots of other nice work. You can look at fluctuations, see Brownian motion. You can do all kinds of things with heavy mesons moving through the plasma. A little bit more recently, you can look at light quark jets, where you have, say, a back-to-back quark-antiquark pair produced at very, very high energy. Effectively look at the dynamics of that very ultra-relativistic quark as it moves through the plasma, slowly loses energy. And for example, I pull the plot here of the rate of energy loss, where, in fact, the largest energy loss occurs essentially right at the end of this process where this highly relativistic quark eventually slows down. So I went through this quickly just to basically put in your heads a palette, a smorgasbord of some of the physics which has been explored using this machinery of gauge gravity duality. But none of that is what I want to talk about today. What I want to talk about is, in essence, the next category of more difficult things. Namely, suppose you are not close to equilibrium, but you're far from equilibrium. One of the great promises of gauge gravity duality is this sort of physics can actually be accessible. Maybe not easily, but at least it's infinitely more accessible than it is doing far from equilibrium dynamics in a theory which is a interacting quantum field theory. So in this context, questions of interest include things like how do you form a plasma in the first place? How does it thermalize? In principle, you can ask questions about turbulence. All of these things are going to turn into problems which are non-trivial initial value problems in gravity. So you're talking about non-trivial evolution in gravity, which is an interesting challenge. I'm not going to say anything about turbulence today. I'm going to talk about problems which basically explore those first two things. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a string which is whose endpoints are separating but is falling in the geometry. So it's a non-stationary evolution, which I would be happy to talk about more, but not now. I mean, all the usual, within the context of large N, large lambda, a particular initial state that you're studying, yes. Yeah, a a D7 brain that fills the entire geometry. So you're describing massless fundamental representation quarks. Okay, we can come back to that if you want. But now I want you to think about how do you actually do some sort of problem that involves non-equilibrium behavior, perhaps far from equilibrium behavior. Something that's completely generic, having nothing to do with the specifics, is any sort of problem like that, you've got to think about how you're going to specify the initial state. And, well, how you're going to usefully specify the initial state. And clearly, you know, there is some complete statistical density matrix, and if I hand it to you in principle, that completely determines the future time evolution, and this is true but utterly useless. You're never going to actually describe an initial state that way. On the gravity side, I could say I just pick initial data for gravity on some Cauchy hypersurface. That's also essentially arbitrary, no good intuition. You should think about that as equally horrible as just saying pick arbitrarily some density matrix. What's clearly nicer, and what appears in essentially all discussions of non-equilibrium physics, going however far back you want, is you want to model exactly what you do in the lab. You start with some initial state that's easy to describe, namely equilibrium, and you do something to it. And if you want to be far from equilibrium, okay, you shake it hard instead of shaking it just a little bit. But you have some well-defined process that starts from a simple initial state, produces some interesting non-equilibrium state, and then you just watch it and see what it does. So conceptually, that's exactly what I want to do. And this just says the same thing in pictures, right? Study time-dependent dynamics, simple initial state, turning on some time-dependent external fields. You can think of those external fields as doing work on the system, exciting it into some non-trivial excited state. Then you stop wiggling your external fields, you let the system evolve, you see what it does. Okay, specifically, what do I want to do? Well, the stress energy tensor in the field theory under gauge gravity duality maps into the metric on the gravity side. So that's the same thing as saying, well, let me say it easier. We already know that the natural external field that you should think of as coupling to the stress energy tensor is simply the metric of four-dimensional space-time. If I want to produce initial states in which the expectation value of the stress energy tensor is doing something interesting, a natural way to do it is to play games with the metric of four-dimensional space. So I want to do field theory not in flat Minkowski space, but in some space-time that begins as Minkowski space, but then there's some time dependence and something changes. All right, this whole talk is basically an exploratory effort to see what you can do in this direction, so I'm going to focus on, obviously, some of the easiest initial examples. One thing you can do is to consider physics where you have perfect spatial homogeneity, but you have time dependence. So imagine that the space-time metric in which we live has time-dependent factors which are producing some anisotropy. I'm going to be focusing on anisotropy basically for reasons that are motivated from real Rick collisions. Understanding how the anisotropy of the early stages of heavy ion collisions locally disappears and how quickly you approach some approximation of local equilibrium is an interesting puzzle. For today, just accept it. I want to look at problems which are going to be exploring the physics of relaxation of anisotropy. So to produce some anisotropy, I simply stretch, say, the x and y directions of space relative to the z directions of space. All right, here's just a little caricature of time running upward. for some region of time, I'm going to choose these functions to be doing something, to not be constant. That's going to be doing work on the system. Then they're going to become constant. The system is going to relax. What I want to point out is that as long as there's no spatial gradients whatsoever, the relaxation of a system in this scenario won't have anything to do with hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics is all about modes that have small but non-zero spatial gradients. You can't excite hydrodynamic modes if you never have spatial gradients. So this case is essentially exploring the relaxation of non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. I'm also going to talk about a second case, which is... Yes, yes. In a particular way, which goes into it in a way that's initially very anisotropic. Right. So... That means that, you know, in this region here, you'll have some non-zero energy density, absolutely. But you will have, for example, stresses. The diagonal elements of the stress tensor in the x and y directions can be dramatically different than what they are in the z direction. If you wait long enough and you go up here somewhere, it should approach very close to equilibrium, in which you have exactly the same energy density, because it can't go anywhere, everything's homogeneous, but the eigenvalues of the stress tensor become identical. Okay, a second variant I want to talk about, which is a little more recent, is the case of boost invariance. Think of a system in which I have two spatial directions in which absolutely nothing is happening, and there will be no dependence on X perp anywhere. I have one longitudinal direction. Instead of using the same sort of Cartesian coordinate z, I'll switch to using coordinates that amount to proper time and rapidity. So the natural picture to have in mind is this sort of space-time picture. In this case, I'm playing games with the geometry in this red region. After the geometry starts changing, we'll have some far from equilibrium system in the yellow region that will eventually relax. The key difference between the first case and the second case is now there actually will be both the physics of hydrodynamic relaxation as well as the physics of non-hydrodynamic modes. Right? But in both cases, we'll have some expectation of T mu nu, which is simple and diagonal with an energy density and pressures, and two transverse pressures, which from the O2 invariance are the same, and a longitudinal pressure that can be different. It is boost invariant, but I think the easiest way of saying that physically is something which is undergoing this sort of boost invariant process. It's sort of similar to cosmology. It's an expanding system. The energy density is decreasing, and it's only decreasing like a power law. And the long time tails on everything that happens in this setup, which are precisely described by hydrodynamic modes. I mean, it's... That's the easiest way of saying it. This is a physically different situation from that situation. That's simplest. Oh, so I didn't say... So in either case, I want the initial state to be something simple, namely either a thermal equilibrium state or even simpler than that, just the vacuum state. Well, so same thing here. So, oh, let me say that. So look at the metric in this form. If this function gamma vanishes, then this metric is just flat space rewritten in terms of different coordinates. Now, this function gamma is again, well, it's stretching the two transverse coordinates relative to what happens to the rapidity and in a time-dependent fashion. So I'm going to show you specific choices for this time-dependent function gamma or this thing I called f up there. They're just choices. But in any case, it's the same qualitative picture. We'll have vacuum up until you enter this red region. Then we're making a time-dependent change in the geometry, and we're looking at the response. Yes. No, I'm forcing external fields, namely the geometry, to have prescribed time dependence. The response in Team UNU is whatever the field theory wants to do. Yes. I haven't yet got to the five-dimensional description. This is just the field theory problem. Okay, now here's the five-dimensional description. So, okay, you already know it's going to be solving 5D Einstein's equations. The change from all the other examples you've heard of is that now I want to do it with time-dependent boundary conditions, so I don't just have flat Minkowski space on the boundary. Same prescription that extracting Team UNU is going to come from the asymptotic near-boundary behavior of the five-dimensional geometry. What is now inevitable is that we're going to have a horizon forming. From the field theory perspective, that's inevitable because we're doing work on the system. It's producing a non-zero energy density everywhere. At late times, there has to be something that's going to be close to a thermal equilibrium state. And you've already heard that thermal equilibrium states are dual to black holes or black brains in this description. This problem happens to be a beautiful illustration of something that every relativist knows well, but I still think is worth emphasizing, which is that event horizons depend on the entire future history of the space-time. And in this setting, what that means is we're going to have a geometry which is undistorted ADS up until the perturbation acts. Well, the perturbation acts on the boundary, so what that really means is undistorted ADS up until the boundary of the future of this point on the horizon. We're going to end up with a horizon located at some ADS radius, but that horizon extends all the way into the infinitely far past. It cannot appear at some point and not exist previously. It always exists, which means down here in the far past, our field theory is exactly in its vacuum. It has zero entropy. Nothing interesting has happened, and yet there's an event horizon. A particularly glaring illustration of the fact that the area of this event horizon cannot be telling you anything interesting in the field theory. Yes? Yes?
So suppose at the very far past, I just send a signal from I to 0, I should be able to reach boundary. So what is then?
If we had, so if we had undistorted ADS, you could start arbitrarily far past, close to r equals 0, send a signal out, and it's going to go out and out and out, and eventually somewhere up here make it to the boundary. Well, maybe my drawing isn't right. But the point is, as that signal's propagating, it reaches the surface on which the geometry starts changing. And so your signal no longer propagates like a geodesic in ADS, and at this point it discovers, oh, I can't make it out as easily as I could. Yeah, yeah, this red curve is a light-like geodesic that's trying to get out as fast as it can.
But I don't understand, because the light-like curve, Yeah, because a massive particle takes a finite time to reach the bright, or to reach from the center to the boundary. And from this picture,
finite time is. I mean, this is a coordinate-dependent thing, so you should ask, what sort of coordinates am I drawing here?
Yeah, but in the past, the standard ABS coordinate should be right.
Hold that thought. I'll say no later, but hold that thought. This is a coordinate system in which ingoing null geodesics are at 45 degrees. No surprises there. Outgoing null geodesics are not at 45 degrees, and as somebody, Krishna, said, this red line is an outgoing null geodesic that doesn't actually make it out. Correct. Correct. Let's not spend a lot of time on that. I mean, in the field theory, I have a field theory in unbounded space. For finite n, as far as any meaningful observable is concerned, that theory still thermalizes. Right.
Far in the past, none of those expectations can hold.
Right.
When does it start to hear it? Is there a way to ask when it starts to be interpretable? When does it hear it?
I don't have a crisp answer to that, and if you want, we can come back to that at the end. Asymptotically. Okay, so that's the goal. What does it take to do it? Well, gravitational initial value problem. You begin by choosing some coordinates. I will argue for this class of problems, coordinates which you've been misled into thinking are the obvious choice are not a good choice. Good choices are coordinates which really are adapted to the dynamics of stuff falling in from the boundary. And I could give technical reasons for that, but I think the simple physical argument is good enough. Namely, we're driving this system by doing something on the boundary. All the physics is tied up with how information propagates from the boundary into the bulk. So we might as well use coordinates that are well adapted to that. Okay, so good coordinates are these. Here's a ansatz for the metric that is consistent with the symmetries that I assumed for either of my two cases. I'm going to call V a coordinate which plays the role of time, but it's really a null coordinate that's constant on ingoing null geodesics. This happens to be the equation that determines outgoing null geodesics. It depends on the value of this metric function A that multiplies dV squared. To make equations look nice and simple, I'm going to define primes to mean derivatives with respect to R, which you should really realize are directional derivatives along these incoming null geodesics. And instead of writing derivative with respect to V, I'll write this sort of redefined derivative, which I'll call G dot, which is nothing but a directional derivative along outgoing null geodesics. Shouldn't be too surprising that there's something natural about those choices. Those two different cases I mentioned will satisfy exactly the same equations, exactly the same ansatz. The only difference is the boundary conditions you want to impose as R goes to infinity. Okay, so various people have talked about perturbing Einstein's equations. You get some ordinary differential equations, you solve them. I don't know if anybody has actually shown a non-trivial complete set of Einstein's equations in the last few weeks. There is, of course, a good reason for that. Normally, in any problem of this sort, when you do that, well, you have two or three pages of hideous stuff to write down. And with this metric, you just grind out Einstein's equations, and at first it looks pretty hideous. You then spend a few days or a few weeks playing around with it, looking at it in pretty remarkable care, and there's an amazing simplification. So Einstein's equations with this setup have only five non-trivial components. Here are five equations which are just cleverly chosen linear combinations of Einstein's equations, rewritten in terms of my null directional derivatives, and you should really be impressed at how simple that is. I mean, it's astonishing. My ansatz for the metric only had three unknown functions. Obviously, we've got too many equations. This always happens with gravity. We have dynamical equations, and we have constraint equations. The only little twist here with these null coordinates is you have one constraint, which you should think of as an initial value constraint, that's if it's satisfied at one value of my time coordinate v, the other equations guarantee that it's satisfied at all other values. But in addition, there's something that you should think of as a boundary value constraint. If it's satisfied at one value of r, then the other equations guarantee that it's true at all values of r. Yeah, lambda's one. You see it right there, lambda. Yeah. Right, so if you look at this, you'll see A satisfies an equation which is just A double prime equals stuff. There's no term that has an A dot. A is like an auxiliary field, just like the electrostatic potential. B, if you remember the metric ansatz, B is really telling you how big is the anisotropy. It's where all that dynamics is. It actually satisfies an equation which, as far as B alone is concerned, is linear. And then there's this other metric function, sigma. Okay, so what could be simpler? I mean, a few little partial differential equations, but I mean, you can write them on the back of an envelope. You type them into your favorite computer algebra program. You say, here are my boundary conditions, get to work, give me the answer. And it fails completely. I was going to use a cruder statement. There's no way. In particular, Mathematica can't even come close to really understanding the separation of what's dynamics from constraints and how it should deal with it. You've got to help it. You can do that. The easiest way to do that is to explicitly solve for the velocities. So convert this system, which had implicit dynamics, into a system of equations with explicit dynamics, explicit time derivatives. And you can actually do that rather nicely. So the two real dynamical fields, here are their time derivatives written in terms of stuff. And if you're naive, you then say, okay, I've separated the constraints. I now have explicit dynamics. Hand it to Mathematica, get to work. Mathematica says, huh, this is no longer a differential equation. It doesn't like integral differential equations, so forget that. So you roll up your sleeves and you say, well, bugger, I'm going to have to convert by hand these 1 plus 1 dimensional partial differential equations into a coupled system of ordinary differential equations by simply discretizing one of my variables, which I'm obviously going to choose to be my radial variable. Completely straightforward. You take those set of coupled ODEs, you stick them on a computer, and now it can at least integrate, and it promptly produces garbage. And this is a point at which to say, this is a simple numerical relativity problem. There's obviously a big community of professional numerical relativists. At least so far, there hasn't been a great deal of transfer of this is the right way to do things from one domain to the other, because Most of the work in numerical relativity has been concerned with things like black hole dynamics and asymptotically flat space. I'm interested here in a problem where you have an asymptotically ADS, or, well, ADS plus some imposed time-dependent Wiggles geometry. That is a profound fundamental difference. And numerical schemes which would work just fine in asymptotically flat space completely fall apart with asymptotic ADS. Basically, the bottom line is you've got to be doing a very good job treating the geometry close to the boundary, or garbage from your numerical imprecision and treatment of a boundary at some point is going to propagate into the space, come back, completely pollute the future evolution. So the bottom line is basically you've got to treat the near boundary behavior analytically, have a useful asymptotic expansion. You've got to carefully match that asymptotic expansion to the numerics, which you can do. Okay, more practical issues. I won't really mention this. My ansatz for the metric almost but not quite used up my reparameterization freedom. The remaining freedom is just a time-dependent reparameterization of R. You need to get rid of that. The easy way is to just demand that one coefficient in that asymptotic expansion vanish. We're going to be describing geometries which have horizons, and if you tried to integrate inside the horizon, you'd eventually run into a singularity. It's inside a horizon, so you don't care, but you need to teach your computer where to stop caring. Right, you want to just excise the region that's either at or a little bit inside the horizon. And of course, you've got to choose exactly what the problem is. So I'm going to show you results for those two cases I discussed. The first case, we chose a boundary time evolution, which is just the simple sort of smoothed out step function, where you control the width of that step and you control its amplitude. So two arbitrary parameters. In the boost invariant case, well, we had actually improved our methods a little bit. So here I'm going to show you results where the time-dependent function actually has compact support, which is not the case over here. But again, it's characterized by a width, a height, and a location for where the bump happens. If you'll let me substitute your "are you at zero temperature" by the statement "are you in the ground state," I mean, that's... I think that's a reasonable way to look at it. A time-dependent R minimum. Yeah, we put a boundary condition, which is to just to basically essentially a free boundary condition. You're free to do anything you want. This is important, right? So exactly how I define my last discretized equation at R min, you know, you can make a choice, I can make a different choice that will affect things in the future, but it'll only affect things in the future inside the horizon. The influence of that different change won't propagate out. So we just made the simplest choice. Okay, that's, I think, all I have to say about sort of how you do it. I'll skip over the fact that you actually need a good graduate student. There's lots of ways to screw up. You've got to test what you're doing. But bottom line is, you can make this work. Let me show you some results. So first I'll show you results for that first case where we had three-dimensional homogeneity. We perturbed the system with that tanh step function. This is a plot of the metric function, which is really telling you how big is the anisotropy, its value. Here's the boundary. On the other side is the horizon. Its value on the boundary here, right, is in fact just that forcing function. It's constant in the past. It's constant in the future with a different constant. And that was our choice. We have boring vacuum. We then stretch space and wait for it to settle down. In between, non-trivial stuff happens. If you go and evaluate the stress energy tensor, well, the red curve here is the energy density. P perp is the transverse stress, or the XX and YY components of the stress tensor. P parallel is the ZZ component of the stress tensor. So, you know, real briefly, nothing initially. Moderately crazy stuff happens. Stuff settles down to constant energy density, longitudinal pressure equal transverse pressure. This is just a thermal equilibrium state at the end. Right. We're looking at a conformal theory. Right. Rapidly. Now, this is for a particular value of the strength of that perturbation, and you can ask how things change as you vary that strength. Before I go on, I'll just comment. You notice things like the energy density going negative. There's no reason it can't. It's quantum field theory. It can't stay negative forever. Everything is translationally invariant in space. This is a plot in the field theory of pressures and energy density as a function of time. Remember V, it's my name of my time variable.
So what is the difference from the, maybe I'm confused, what's the difference from just the initial things you have, for example, that energy density plot? So that seems the profile in the matrix.
The value of this function right along that edge, that was my choice.
That is the choice for the boundary matrix?
That's the boundary condition that I fed in, right? The value of this function everywhere in the interior, that's what Einstein's equations can dictate. To extract the energy density, as always, you're interested in the subleading asymptotic behavior of the appropriate component of the metric. That only comes out after you've solved Einstein's equations. That's not trivially related to my choice of that boundary condition. Okay. Horizons. So this picture, well, let's see. First of all, the coloring is showing you the value of that metric function A, which determines, well, which appears in the geodesic equation for outgoing null geodesics. So superimposed on that, you see pictures of a geodesic congruence, which are these blue lines. And let me just start over here on the left. If you only looked at the left side of this plot, all you see is a bunch of parallel straight lines, and those are just outgoing null geodesics in ADS space. And as long as they can continue, they all reach the boundary up here. All right, but the geometry starts changing, stuff happens, you see this geodesic congruence changes, and you obviously see this bifurcation again between geodesics, which are going to reach the boundary, and geodesics, which turn around and are going to crash into the singularity, except this was the region where we just didn't bother to calculate. And separating them is a very special geodesic that neither reaches the boundary nor crashes into the singularity, and that's the event horizon, shown there as the sort of dark black line. Inside the event horizon is the apparent horizon defined by the outermost trapped surface. That's this dashed green line. All right, and if you look at the area of those two, well, just what I said. The event horizon has an area which is non-zero, arbitrarily far in the past. The apparent horizon essentially starts from zero at this time, grows, but they both asymptotically become equal. Okay, you can look at this a little more carefully. You can define some measure of an isotropization time. We defined a measure which simply says, when are the pressures in the transverse and longitudinal directions equal to within 10% for all times in the future? The first time where that was true is what I call the isotropization time here. The only scale in the problem, the only time scale, is the time scale that was defined by how rapidly you change the boundary geometry. So for example, the final temperature you equilibrate at must be related to that time scale that was associated with your boundary forcing. I'm not going to spend time going through numbers here, especially because I want to show you case two. I will just jump to the end and say, if you look at all the information here, you see that this isotropization time measured by this very simple little toy problem is, well, roughly on the order of 0.7 over the temperature. Now, if you feel like it, you're free to plug in some interesting values of the temperature and see what you get and make of that result whatever you want. If you happen to plug in 350 MeV, out comes about half a Fermi over C. Let me come back to that after I show you a little bit more. And so I have a few things to say, whether it's really understanding, to discuss. Let me show you case two, which is a little bit more interesting. So, same sort of picture here, same metric function, same geodesic congruence. What you notice now is the horizon, okay, there's the event horizon, it's growing, 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 but in terms of where it is in the radial coordinate, it then starts moving inward. That's going to be associated with cooling in this boost invariant expansion. The horizon area, well, you should first of all, nobody asked me, why is the area finite? I have something which is infinite in transverse direction. So this is really an area per unit transverse area, if you will. In this problem, you should really think of it essentially as a co-moving area element. So even though in this picture it looks like the horizon is falling, and in terms of what you've seen about ADS black holes, that means the temperature is going down and therefore the entropy is going down. Well, but this whole thing is in an expanding geometry. So the actual entropy per co-moving volume should go to a non-zero constant, and that's exactly related to the horizon area that's actually going to a non-zero constant, even though this is moving down, down, down in the radial direction. All right, once again, there's an apparent horizon hiding inside the true event horizon. If you plot energy or pressures, again, crazy wiggles for a while, and then stuff settles down. The difference is now you can clearly see tails. So it's not settling down as rapidly as it did in the previous one, and those tails are actually going to be hydrodynamic physics. No. So this is now sourcing with that function, which was just a single bump, actually had compact support. And the precise numbers, just for you to look at these plots, I should tell you, are such that the support of the forcing goes between time of 1/4 and 2 1/4. So essentially, all these crazy wiggles is while you're forcing the geometry, right? You're stopping the forcing at 2 1/4.
Very close to the vacuum, but you still have a non-zero entropy.
You still have a non-zero entropy per co-moving volume. Your entropy density is shrinking power law. Right. No. I mean, the asymptotic solution is pure ADS, but the first corrections are not something you describe that way. N is infinity. So all of, So all of the time scales, all of that physics has finite limit as n goes to infinity. The energy density, the pressure, all of that stuff has an overall factor of n squared, which has just been divided out in showing you all these plots, as far as n counting is concerned. So in this conformal theory, ultimately the only thing which is setting a time scale is the time scale over which you did work on the system. So it's coming back to my choice of those forcing functions. And I'll show you some slightly more detailed data that's trying to make that correlation explicit. Yes? Correct. Precisely. Nothing. I mean, nothing's carrying information. So you can describe it that way. But now take a limit where you make the size of your sheet larger and larger. Right? Yes, you've stretched it anisotropically, so you can say one direction stretched and one direction shrank. But all, I mean, the edges of the sheet are all infinitely far away. I'll just say one of the nice things about this setup is you never needed to think about the boundary of spatial infinity. You know, there's a lot of other physics that would come in, which is related to thinking about, you know, finite blobs of plasma, which is a real physical motivation to be interested in, but that's harder. I mean, this is a warm-up problem. Well, in equilibrium, and only in equilibrium, the entropy is related to the area of the horizon, and it doesn't matter whether you say event horizon or apparent horizon. Mm-hmm. This is not a simple issue. A question, so I'd like to say that there's an answer to that where it's related to the apparent horizon, because it clearly can't be related to the event horizon. But you've got to do better than what you just said. You can't just say, let's pretend that the energy density, let's equate it with what it would be if we were in equilibrium and infer an entropy. Okay. In the second case, as I said, the long time dynamics is described by hydrodynamics. That means you can compare the fully nonlinear GR time evolution with what you would get if you just solved hydrodynamics. And this is a nice test case because various people, a bunch of them down here, have already spent a bunch of time and effort analyzing the asymptotically late time dynamics of systems that precisely include the system we're describing here. And so what you know, for example, is the energy density falls like 1 over this proper time to the 4/3, up to corrections. There's an asymptotic expansion in higher powers of 1 over time to the 2/3. And we know the coefficient. So there's an asymptotic expansion for energy density pressure, also for these event horizon areas. So you have an expansion where the control parameter is 1 over time multiplied by some characteristic energy, which will ultimately be determined by my choice of forcing function. In pictures, here are pictures of energy density and pressures for three different amplitudes of the forcing. Dotted lines are these next to leading order hydrodynamic expansions. And first of all, they agree pretty well at late times. This is a, yes. So at the very least, this is first a very reassuring demonstration that our numerics is not garbage, which is a non-trivial test. All right, beyond that, these pictures, the upper pictures, are only showing time here after the boundary forcing is turned off. So what you see is that they're, depending on the value of C, there's some time where hydrodynamics is not a good description, and then there's a time where it becomes a good description. Again, I'll arbitrarily define 10% deviation from hydrodynamics as the edge of the hydrodynamic regime. You can also compare the event horizon areas. I won't say anything about that in detail, except to say they agree really well, and in fact, they agree. C is the overall amplitude. What's the magnitude of your forcing? The width is chosen. In all of these plots, I'm keeping the width fixed and just changing the magnitude. No, those are calculated. Those are known. These are results which are valid for conformal fluids. So all you have to know is we're studying here a theory which is describing a conformal fluid. It has to agree at late times with hydrodynamics with these values of those coefficients.
So, do you need to have those next to leading order to have this agreement with hydro? Like, you have a leading order thing that is not okay, it did not agree until significantly later time?
So, good question. And in terms of these pictures, what you've shown here, if I neglected the second order hydro term, it will make the agreement a little bit less. You can easily see it. But it's not really dramatic. It's not a big effect. If you didn't have the first term, which is the first viscous term, then it really looks bad. Precisely. And that's true. And I'll comment on that. First, I'll overwhelm you with a bunch of numbers, which I don't really expect you to look at. But just to say, we've looked at this for a range of Cs. The only thing I draw your attention to here is this third line, which is this combination of parameters, lambda times tau star. Tau star is, again, my criteria for the first time at which hydrodynamics becomes a good description. And what you should note here is that lambda times tau star is always about 1 or bigger. If you go back to these expansions that I just flashed at you, and you look at these coefficients, these series are beautifully behaved when lambda times tau star is 1 or larger. If you say, where does this term become comparable to that term, or so on, it's somewhere around lambda tau star is 0.1. So the message here is that for all values of the forcing we've looked at the earliest time where hydrodynamics is a good description, the higher order terms in the hydrodynamic expansion are already tiny. So in other words, the onset of the hydrodynamic regime is not being controlled by when the gradient expansion, which is what's going on in that hydrodynamic expansion, is becoming ill-behaved. It's not controlled by when second-order terms are comparable to first-order terms. Therefore, instead, it must be being controlled by when non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom, those things at which we're doing the wild oscillations, are finally becoming small enough to ignore. Pavel asked about large C. Things seem to change, seems to relax instantly. And that's actually true. Right? Here, the largest value of C, you agree with hydrodynamics sooner than you do with small c. At first sight, that might seem peculiar. The time scale, that's being held fixed.
So,
I mean, they're completely independent. And for everything I'm showing you, I'm keeping that width fixed in such a way that you're doing forcing between this time and that time. I mean, of course, that's a matter of units, right? I'm simply using units where that width is fixed. Here, I just want to mention that, you know, here if you hit the system harder, if you try and drive it away from equilibrium harder and harder, what you're seeing is it returns to equilibrium faster and faster. This might seem peculiar, but again, this is a conformal theory. If I do an enormous amount of work on it, I'm going to end up with a system with an extremely high energy density, which when it's approximately thermalized will have a very high temperature, and the only time scale that can determine any of the physics is then set by 1 over that very large temperature. So that's all you're seeing here, that you hit it harder and harder, and it is relaxing faster and faster because it can, because it has higher energy. In our data, well, if you, for example, say, how long after you stop forcing the system do you reach this edge of the hydrodynamic regime, as measured in units of the effective temperature at the edge of the hydrodynamic regime, that's exactly this line. Zero means it's faster than we can extract from our data. I believe it's fair to say you should look at our data as being pretty darn good, but there are limits. I don't really know how to really get too quantitative about just how fast that's happening.
I think your argument works if you scale your shape and the height at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think your argument will work. That's the only reason I'm able to do. But I think if you only change the height but not change the reach, then you only have a scale in the reach.
Well, I'm using units in width that width defines my scale of energy. I'm changing the height, and that means I'm actually putting more and more energy in the system. So I'm precisely using units which match my description.
Yeah, but you have another scale.
Which is defining the scale that I'm using in order to say whether energy is larger or smaller. We can come back to this. This is just packaging. Okay, I'm not only out of time, but on my last slide. So, I found this an instructive exercise, which was in fact initiated in conversations in the hall out here the previous time I was visiting the Institute. The specific output in terms of thermalization times, I think, makes qualitative sense. Whether it's really applicable to RIC or not is just an open question. I'm not going to weigh in on that one way or the other. As a first exploration in terms of can you actually use this machinery of gauge gravity duality to do really non-trivial initial value problems far from equilibrium? I was pretty heartened by how well things worked out. None of this is big scale computing. It's just a certain amount of cleverness in massaging the equations to a good form. There are obvious questions. Exploring the class of problems we've already done, but with a wider set of forcing functions. I'm not sure that's the most interesting thing. I already alluded to issues about to what extent do we really understand the connection between entropy and horizon area. This class of problems, I think, rubs your nose in the fact that we don't really have a satisfactory understanding. An obvious question for sort of semi-practical purposes is to just say, how much farther can you go? This was a class of problems that was reducible to 1+1 dimensional differential equations. They're harder than ordinary differential equations. There's plenty of problems that are reducible to, say, 2+1 or 3+1 dimensional PDEs. I have some hope of doing an interesting problem that's colliding shocks, non-boost invariant shocks. That, I think, is a sort of prototype 2+1 PDE problem, which I'm hoping is doable. I don't know yet. Lots of more complicated things. Don't ask about turbulence. I think I'll stop there. So if I had fewer scruples, I would tell you a story about how compelling evidence from hydrodynamic modeling of Rick data leads you to believe that what's actually produced in heavy ion collisions approximately thermalizes in less than a Fermi over C, and how this is hard to understand from estimates based on perturbative QCD. No, the scruples come in then saying, here is the answer. That takes lack of scruples. So it is true that here we're studying a system which has, by design, arbitrarily strongly coupled interactions. And we see approach to near thermalization that you could argue was as fast as you could hope for. What we really learn, let me go back to the case one, which is just a little bit easier to discuss. I mean, here you have a setup where you produce some asymptotic final temperature T. The isotropization time has to be proportional to 1/T, because what else could it be? But there could have been a factor of 10 there, or 4 pi. You know, what we learn is that the coefficient really is slightly less than 1. Interesting. Plug in numbers, you get something which is less than a Fermi over C. So I could declare success. Frankly, I am not comfortable doing that. I think it's clear that real heavy ion collisions in their earliest stages, some sort of partonic description, which is based on weak interactions in QCD, is the appropriate language. 1 Fermi over C later, it seems to be the case that a completely different description is appropriate. We have no good way of really describing the physics in that first Fermi over C, and I can't stand here with a straight face and say that a satisfactory answer could possibly come from a process where step one is assume the coupling equals infinity.
So just all the caveats I completely agree with, just to stress the numerical coincidence, from the hydrodynamic literature statement we see completely hard to as much an expert on these methods as anyone is in order to understand the data you need to look at equilibration by 0.6 to 1 Fermi, somewhere between 0.6 and 1 Fermi. one Fermi in his calculations, the temperature is somewhere around, if I remember correctly, around 270 MeV. So actually, if you took 270 MeV and made reference to 270, that 0.5 would be more like 0.7, and it's like bang on it.
No, I agree.
And so that really shows how difficult this is, the experimental result is from this point. It's a major story.
That's being equated, that's being regarded as the answer to the time where local thermalization is a good approximation. Well, I mean, that's essentially just what I was doing in my case too. That was precisely what I was doing. I mean, you still have evolution. You're not in equilibrium. But I was defining my T star as when a hydrodynamic description is accurate. But this is, I think, a point to add one cautionary note. The actual hydrodynamic modeling of rip collisions, I mean, it's improved a lot from the early days where it was completely non-viscous ideal fluids, and now people are doing viscous hydrosimulations. They have both first order and second order viscous terms in their equations. And it is natural to ask them, why should you trust your application of hydrodynamics, which nominally is only valid when space-time gradients are arbitrarily small? Can you trust that when it's being applied, say in the early stages of this collision? What the practitioners say, which is the only thing they can say, is, for example, they can study their sensitivity to their second order coefficients in their hydrodynamic description, and they see weak sensitivity. From that perspective, this should be a cautionary note, that test could actually really be misleading you, and there could be physics which just isn't captured at all that's still important. You can manipulate how hard you hit the system.
How long can you make it? Can you ever get 5 over 2 instead of 0.7 over 2?
No. Because all you're doing is changing T. Well, take a gold nucleus. It's about 15 fermis in diameter, boost it to 200 GeV per nucleon, which is a Lorentz contraction factor of 100. So your pancake nuclei, you should now think of as 0.15 fermis. That's the simplest answer to what you said. Well, this problem which Paul and I are hoping to do, but no promises yet, of looking at colliding shocks is an attempt to at least come closer to that, where you really have two shock waves which really have finite width, because it really doesn't make any sense to try and solve it in the limit where they have zero width. Watch those shock waves come in and collide. That would at least be an interesting caricature. Yes? They're not doing the full problem. There's a literature where they try and look at asymptotics, early time or late time. And much of what's been done is trying to make sense of initial conditions which are horribly singular. where essentially you have squares of delta functions or something equally repulsive in the energy density. And I don't know how to make sense of that. Certainly anything you're going to do numerically, forget it. Yeah, I've talked about that with Paul.
Can you give us a sensible?
No. I don't know how to make sense of a delta prime energy density in some sort of shock. Mm-hmm. So he had, the bulk of his analysis was looking at a lower dimensional example in the limit where you only weakly hit the system. Other than that, the framework is the same, but he just barely pinged the system and he looked at it in one dimension down. And in that limit, to leading order in the strength of the ping, there was essentially no delay, there was essentially instant thermalization. As he himself said, that's not true if you look at second order, it's not true if you go up in dimension. So, it's not, what I'm saying is not inconsistent with what he said, but in that very special limit, in some sense, you saw even faster thermalization. No.
Was this the paper where he tried to just make a Fourier transformation? You should try the black hole and get the funny Fourier.
No, I think he also actually made this
He didn't actually calculate shockwave collisions. He talked about it, but yeah. I mean, so what actually went into it, I think, was exactly what you said, which is just looking at the back. Well, it was looking at quasi-normal modes around the global ADS black hole, analytically continued back to Minkowski space. Now, you know, it should be mentioned that in the quasi-normal mode spectrum, say close to equilibrium, you see frequencies which are faster than 1 over the temperature, or like 1 over 3 pi times the temperature. So, you know, our measure, by construction, is not a measure that's saying, look asymptotically far out at infinitesimally small perturbations and say, how fast are they relaxing? Right? We have a much more sort of operational definition, and the answer is different, but is closer to just 1 over the temperature.